Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the three Republican-appointed judges on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, one of whom was put on the court by Trump, handing him a victory on the emoluments case brought by the District of Columbia and Maryland against Trump for accepting money from state and foreign governments via his hotel in Washington and his other business enterprises. While no other president has ever made money out of his family businesses while in office, Trump nevertheless tweeted out today that he won a victory against the deep state, although the issue at stake is spelled out in the Constitution. It's just that the Emoluments Clause has been dormant since the Constitution was written, that is, until Trump came along. Joining us is Corey Brettschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University and a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School, and author of The Oath and the Office, a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. We'll discuss how this lawless president is now being protected by the chief law enforcement officer in the land, the Attorney General William Barr, who is now brazenly acting as Trump's personal attorney following the boss's orders to challenge the Supreme Court ruling on the census and to unrecuse himself from the Epstein case. With mounting evidence of Trump's criminal business practices, his possible treasonous relationship with Putin, and his association, if not complicity, with the convicted child sex trafficker, it appears that the Republicans are desperately shielding Trump in the hope that the truth won't come out and they won't go down with the ship of sleaze. Then, with Labor Secretary Acosta's press conference today in which he tried to defend the indefensible sweetheart deal he made with the child sex trafficker Epstein, we will examine Acosta's plan to cut 80% of the Labor Department's budget to combat child sex trafficking. Kathleen Kim, a professor of law at Loyola Law School, who is the co-director of the Anti-Trafficking Litigation Assistance Support Team, joins us to discuss Acosta's planned evisceration of the Labor Department's International Labor Affairs Bureau and Trump's constant refrain that Acosta is doing a great job. Then finally, with billionaire Tom Steyer, the latest candidate to enter the Democratic presidential campaign, just as one tail-ender dropped out, we will speak with Morris Pearl, the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, where he has a recent article, Rich People's Charity Won't Save the World. He joins us to discuss whether a billionaire posing as a populist outsider, as Trump did, but Steyer is an actual billionaire, can get traction in the crowded field. Meanwhile, Steyer is spending $90 million on television ads calling for Trump's impeachment, ads that feature him on camera. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Corey Brettschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writing has appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times, and he is the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. Welcome to Background Briefing, Corey Brettschneider.
Thanks, Ian. Pleasure to be here with you.
Well, thank you. And in terms of a guide to the Constitution, I would think that the fact that the three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit tossed out the emoluments cases brought by the District of Columbia and Maryland against the Trump Organization in terms of the Constitution's emoluments clause, the fact that they were all appointed by Republican presidents, one of the justices was appointed by Trump himself, you just can't help feeling that this is an example of the politicization of our judiciary. Would you go so far as to say that? Because, again, I would make the case that elections have consequences.
Yes, I definitely think that's true. I mean, I think a collective sigh went up among the two states bringing this case and the Attorney General's office when they found out who the panel was. I think it was sort of a long shot at that point. But I guess I should also say, so it's not a surprise in that sense, but it also is a unique claim. We've never had a situation like this where a president has so blatantly violated the emoluments clause, at least in modern history. There's a tradition of putting assets in blind trusts, and that's just sort of a norm that presidents have followed. But this president, you know, doesn't care anything about norms, and so has really tested us. And now, you know, the Constitution is under a stress test. We don't have any precedent of emoluments violations being litigated in courts, and so we're sort of dealing with these things as we come. And I guess I thought, though, it was unlikely that this specific panel in this specific case was going to do anything. But hope's not lost. There are two other cases that are pending, one by members of Congress, one by a group called Crew that includes representatives of, I think, restaurants and hotels near Trump's hotel that have been adversely affected by his own personal benefiting from his office. That's the violation of the emoluments clause, that he's using the office for personal profit rather than public benefit. So it's discouraging, but I don't think it's over. We've got these two other cases, and we have to wait and see what happens with them.
Well, Trump is definitely triumphant. He tweeted out today, "Word just out that I won a big part of the deep state and Democrat-induced witch hunt. Unanimous decision in my favor from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit on the ridiculous emoluments case. I don't make money, but I lose a fortune for the honor of being your president." So, first of all, this has nothing to do with the deep state, not that the deep state exists. If the best that the deep state can provide us with is Robert Mueller, Trump has nothing to worry about, as far as I can see. But the truth of the matter is that this is about the Constitution, isn't it? This is the Emoluments Clause is in the Constitution. It had nothing to do with the deep state. It has everything to do with the Constitution of the United States, which, by the way, the president just celebrated on the 4th of July in a peculiar way, but nevertheless, he kept referring to it. So can somebody disabuse him of this deep state thing, or do you think a lot of people in this country?
I mean, it just is such a wild claim. I mean, I don't know who he could be talking about, these restaurant owners that are bringing the claims, this group of public-oriented lawyers that are helping to represent them, the members of Congress. They're not members of the deep state. It's being done in the open, and the clauses that they're litigating about, exactly as you say, are written right there in the Constitution. They're not implied. They say that the president is banned from taking emoluments or profiting from his office, both domestically and also internationally. And that's the accusation here, and it's all in the open. So there's nothing deep state or secretive about it. It's about this president's really gross violations. I'll just tell you some of what's in there. To me, one of the things that's not received a lot of attention, but that should, is that China, at the time that he was saber-rattling early in his presidency about recognizing Taiwan, had intellectual property connected to the Trump Organization that was pending. And one of the worries is all of a sudden a lot of that intellectual property got granted, coinciding with the president no longer attacking China at that particular moment. Now, that's an extremely serious accusation, that the foreign policy of the United States is being dictated by a president who cares about his intellectual property. And you could just go through it, and when you hear the fact that he's using his hotel, for instance, to host visiting diplomats and clearly making money on large entourages that are trying to curry favor by staying there at very expensive rates, it's both unprecedented and, frankly, disgusting that he's using the trust of the American people to benefit his organization, his family, and his company.
And again, I'm speaking with Corey Bretschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as being a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. And his writing has appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times. And he is the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Well, we're at a time, Corey, where you get the feeling that, not that this should come as a surprise to most people, but rich and powerful people just seem to get away with a lot nowadays. Look at this fellow Jeffrey Epstein, and there are so many people that seem to roll over for them. And it's not just this Secretary of Labor, Acosta, who made this appalling deal to get Epstein off on the most hideous charges after an intensive FBI investigation involving hundreds of girls, all of which was documented in a very good series in the Miami Herald by Julie Brown. And nevertheless, Acosta gets him off. But I was just reading the New York Times today. Epstein was also being a registered sex offender. There was an attempt to expunge that by Cyrus Vance, the Democrat, the district attorney of New York, and his lawyer tried to make the argument that they should not brand him as a sex offender and reduce it down so that nobody knew about it. And the judge could not believe that the attorney for the Manhattan district attorney was saying that and just threw it out. And then we learn in this article that Cyrus Vance Jr. apparently also stopped a bunch of disgruntled condo owners who got ripped off by Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr., and he expunged that. So is that the way to look at all this? Not just that we know that Trump, we don't even know how criminal he is, and we don't even know the extent to which he's a traitor, and we don't even know the extent to which he may be a pedophile. There's so much stuff out there. But what we do know about him is pretty bad. That's on the record now. And just in the context of being rich and powerful in today's America, how much does it play into all this? Or do you see this more in a constitutional light as being a president that's extraordinary?
I think you're right. This president has a history and is in a tradition of wealthy people being able to break the rules. And, you know, he happens now to be not just a corrupt businessman, but the president of the United States. And the rules that he's breaking, you know, haven't really been tested before. That's what's so difficult. And, you know, going back to Washington, he pledged he wasn't going to take emoluments, and he challenged the country that if he violated the Constitution, including the emoluments clause, to come after him, to stop him, and to subject him to constitutional punishment. So I think, you know, there's a lot of fatigue about the phenomenon that we've been talking about, and about wealthy people getting away with breaking the law and this president getting away with his lawless behavior. But it's really the Constitution in the end can't be entrusted to courts. It's got to be dependent on all of us. That's what I try to argue in the Oath in the Office. I end with emoluments and impeachment. And what I say is, look, there's a good chance that this clause might not be enforced by courts. We can't trust that courts are going to come through for us. And that's why when it comes to a president that's violating the emoluments clause, let's use the mechanism that the people have been given by the Constitution. And that's impeachment in the House and removal by the Senate. Now, I know that those branches might not be moving along, but part of the problem is Nancy Pelosi and others in the House are worried too much about narrow questions of politics rather than doing the right thing. So that's one way to end. Like, yes, we're tired, but I think we've got to push to hold this president to account. And also, we shouldn't give up hope, because there are these two other suits that I think might move forward. And, you know, maybe in the end, this court, despite being tilted certainly towards a very different view of the Constitution, a very conservative one than the one that I hold, might just see the plain meaning of these words on the page of the Constitution and say, you know, the president has to be held to account and forced to not benefit in these grotesque and obvious ways from his office. So, yes, we're tired, but we've got to fight on, both in the courts and I hope also in the political process, because that's, to me, one of the central places that we've got to start talking about emoluments violations.
Well, but we have an attorney general. You know, we know that Trump said, where's my Roy Cohn? He was absolutely right. Treated Sessions, humiliated him so publicly. It was just extraordinary. And now it looks like he has got his personal lawyer, which is what he wanted all along, in William Barr. Because the census question, for example, when you talk about textualists and the original intent of the Constitution, which the conservatives on Supreme Court supposedly believe in, well, how are you going to get around the idea that the Constitution says about the census that you have to count all peoples, not all citizens, right, but all peoples? That's right in the text. So obviously that was a bridge too far for John Roberts to go along with his conservative colleagues. So what happens is, right, I'm sure what happened is that when Trump read the front page of the New York Times where it said Trump yields to the Supreme Court on the census question, right, he got furious because he doesn't yield. He's a macho man. He gets on the phone to William Barr and says, undo this. And lo and behold, right, Barr is doing that. And then, then it gets even worse, because Barr recused himself on the Epstein case. And then he suddenly turned around yesterday and unrecused himself. And again, I suspect he got a phone call from the president saying, you know, don't do what Sessions did. unrecuse yourself. I want you around to look at what's going on with the Epstein case and whether or not Trump's
I think that's right.
Go ahead. Sorry, I don't mean to.
I think that's right, that we have huge reason to be skeptical of this attorney general and the fact that he blatantly lied, and we should put it in as blunt terms as we can, about what was in the Mueller report by claiming that the Mueller report didn't rely on the idea that a sitting president can't be criminally indicted. That was not just misleading, it was a lie that Mueller had to get on television to correct. Now, why would somebody do that unless they were, exactly as you say, acting not as the defender of the people, but as the defender of this president in the narrowest possible way? So I emphatically, strongly agree with what you're saying. I do think on the census case that, you know, we've got to give credit where credit is due. Roberts did stop the Justice Department. They were going to back down. Now they're not. But if you read that opinion, it's pretty good. It says, look, the executive branch said that the reason why they want to ask about citizenship has to do with something about enforcing the Voting Rights Act and helping citizens vote. And, you know, the court was like, sorry, that's not the reason for this question to be asked on the census. And they stopped them in their tracks. Now they're giving them another chance to try to come up with a reason. And I hope that they don't accept, because it's clear what the reason is, which is a sort of attempt to intimidate non-citizens from being counted the way the Constitution demands. But at least on this one, we can give the court credit for stopping an attorney general who is certainly out of control. And, you know, the attorney general did stop an indictment of the president based on the Mueller report and did lie to us about what the Mueller report said. But now we've got Mueller testifying next week, so that's another place that we can fight back. I guess he and I'm a perpetual optimist, even in the face of certainly the worst president in my lifetime and the most offensive to the ideas of the rule of law and the Constitution. But I still believe that the courts, in some instances, can be vindicated. Not all. Certainly, this was a bad ruling by this panel on the Emoluments Clause. And then I trust that the Democrats, with appropriate pressure, will begin to stand up for themselves and stand up for the Constitution.
Well, I wish I was an optimist. I think maybe I'm afflicted. I'm afflicted by having to cover Trump every day. It's my job, and I hate it.
Right.
Because I feel complicit. He's denigrating the press, and you're helping somebody that's denigrating your very profession. But on the other hand, not to be too pessimistic, it doesn't seem like we're out of the woods. You know, there's some murmurs coming from Barr about the testimony by Mueller next week, which clearly he doesn't want, and Trump certainly doesn't want. He may try and weigh in. He even indicated the Justice Department said it may try and prevent the other two members of Mueller's team from also testifying. That's going on, is it not? And just on the other issue of the census, there's one good development on that, and that is that the judge in the case told the DOJ that you can't fire your entire team.
That was a great moment.
And bring on.
That is a moment of optimism that they have to give a reason for wanting to no longer be advocating for the position of the DOJ. And the reason can't be, you know what, this president is not doing his job and is asking us to do stuff that's unethical. And I think, that's another, moment of optimism. Trump will say, of course, that's an Obama appointee and that this is a partisan witch hunt and deep state and all of these things. But I think we've just got to be vigilant. I don't want to be too optimistic either. We don't want to be too pessimistic or too optimistic. It's a crisis when a president who is this powerful and the office has become over the years enormously influential, and with the checks eroding both in the judiciary and, unfortunately, in Congress, with a Republican Senate and a Democratic Congress that is really, to my mind, acting in way too weak a way under the leadership of Nancy Pelosi, there's a chance that the president could win all of these battles, including the census, including certainly getting away with the obstruction of justice documented in the Mueller report, getting away with failing to contact the FBI when foreign government was clearly trying to influence our elections. So it's a serious time, and my kind of optimism or hopefulness, I guess I don't want to veer into being naive and to thinking that victory is inevitable. It's not, and it's a very dangerous time for this country.
Well, just in closing, Corey Bretschneider, I'm sort of racking my brain trying to figure out what makes Barr tick. Why is he being so conspicuously rolling over for this president and enabling him in the worst possible way? The same questions I ask of Lindsey Graham, who as soon as his friend John McCain died, seemed to lose his conscience and then become sort of cravenly pro-Trump. And the only explanation I can come up with is that I've done a lot of research into Trump's connection to the Russians, and it does look as if he was recruited not even by the Putin's people, but by the Soviets back in 87. He's taken all sorts of dirty money, laundered money from the Russian mob. A lot of it may have been KGB money into condos. So good chance he's a traitor. And even the British ambassador who just had to resign today, in his confidential assessment of Trump that went in public, he said you can't rule out the worst as far as Trump's relationship to the Russians. So that's there. The business, his business career is just absolutely outrageous. And then you look at these connections to Epstein and all of his predilection for young women and all this stuff coming out about Epstein and the, all that stuff in his safe. It seems like every day more and more stuff's coming out and Trump's playing defense all the time. And the Republicans are sticking by him absolutely, resolutely. I think they're sticking by him because they're just hoping somehow that the whole dam doesn't burst and the American people find out that the president is not just a traitor, he's a criminal and a pedophile. And that is just what's looming out there. And they're just absolutely doubling down. And this is why maybe the British ambassador said, you know, that Trump is so insecure. I think he's insecure because he knows who he really is and they're closing in on him. And he never was serious about this job. He ran it as a lark to promote his brand, the Trump Organization. And the worst thing that happened to him was he got elected and now he's under some the scrutiny that he's never had before. And so that's my best explanation, that the reason the Republicans are sticking by him is that they don't have a choice. They're just sticking by him in the hope that somehow he can tough this out and the world doesn't find out who this guy really is.
It is a sad, you know, thing to recognize that history is not going to judge well, that the members of the president's own party, when it came to not policy issues, but to the rule of law, to the Constitution, have not stood up to him. And, you know, that's not true of the Nixon era. I think that Elliot Richardson's family and Elliot Richardson himself, when he was alive, could feel proud that they say, he said, no, I'm not going to fire the special prosecutor looking into your wrongdoing. I promised Congress I wouldn't do it. I'm not going to do it. You can fire me. But, you know, no, thank you. I don't just work for you. I have public commitments. And I think that, you know, the Republicans in Congress on the Judiciary Committee who eventually did vote for those articles of impeachment against Nixon, can feel the same way. Now, we haven't seen anything like that from this Republican Party. And, you know, hopefully in the first term of Nixon, there wasn't that kind of resistance from within the party. It came after the election in the second term. And maybe we can, you know, hope the same will happen here. Hopefully not in the second term, but late in the first term.
Well, Corey Bretschneider, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, as always, to speak with you, Ian.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Corey Bretschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. And his writing has appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times. And he's the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking at Labor Secretary Acosta's press conference today, in which he tried to defend the indefensible. Police and peace.
Like you that puts the rest of us to shame. It's a Mr.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kathleen Kim, a professor of law at Loyola Law School and a nationally recognized expert on immigration and human trafficking. She's the co-author of the first casebook on human trafficking and currently co-directs the Anti-Trafficking Litigation Assistance and Support Team and was a gubernatorial appointee to the California Alliance to Global Combating and Slavery. And in 2013, she was appointed to the Los Angeles Police Commission. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kathleen Kim.
Thank you for having me.
And Kathleen, you had a lot to do with the state of California's law on human trafficking, did you not?
That's correct.
So tell us about what you did and how this might well serve as a model on a federal level, because I wanted to talk to you, obviously, about the embattled head of the Department of Labor, which has oversight over human trafficking, and yet in spite of the troubles that Alexander Acosta finds himself in, he's nevertheless proposed that he wants to cut the budget of the Labor Department Human Trafficking Division by 80%. So that's why I called you. But let's just get some context here. Tell us about the laws in California and the extent to which they might well be a model for others.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for that background. You set up the question quite well. The California law was passed in 2005, and it was shortly after the federal government had proposed, and by federal government I mean the Maine Department of Justice, had proposed model legislation for individual states to enact against trafficking. And that's because the federal anti-trafficking law was passed in 2000, and the federal government, seeing a tremendous need for increased efforts and resources to combat human trafficking, encouraged states to follow with their own additional anti-trafficking statutes. The California statute was unique in how comprehensive it was. And myself, along with, this is quite early on in the anti-trafficking movement, so it was myself and a couple of other anti-trafficking experts in California, as well as very strong leaders in the California legislature, that worked together to enact legislation that not only criminalized human trafficking on a state level, but also advanced protections for victims. Protections for victims in the social services arena, as well as provisions in the California state law that interact with the existing federal law to access immigration benefits and other social service benefits from the federal government that would be granted to victims of human trafficking. We also enacted, and I was the chief author of the civil lawsuit provision of the California anti-trafficking law, and it continues to be the civil cause of action that addresses human trafficking that probably has the most breadth in the United States. It provides for compensatory and punitive damages and other kinds of technical legal remedies that highly benefit a trafficked plaintiff who's seeking access to civil justice and then ends up prevailing against a trafficker. Now, with respect to Acosta, it's beyond troubling that he serves as the labor secretary. And I think that ever since 2000, when the Chief Federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act was passed, the Department of Labor was one of the principal federal agencies identified in the legislative proceedings for the enactment of the Trafficking Victims Protection Act that would lead anti-trafficking efforts domestically as well as abroad. The federal law that addresses human trafficking included criminal provisions, victim protections, as well as prevention efforts, again, domestically and abroad. The division of the Department of Labor that is responsible for prevention efforts, particularly prevention efforts abroad, is under Acosta's jurisdiction, and that is the exact division that the budget proposes an 80% cut. And this is the only division that is designed to equip globally, governments across the globe, with prevention methods. You know, how to identify trafficking, how to identify child trafficking, human trafficking in general, and also child labor exploitation. An 80% cut in that budget is quite damaging to our country's responsibility under the Trafficking Act, under our federal law, to advance prevention efforts.
And again, I'm speaking with Kathleen Kim, who's a professor of law at Loyola Law School and a nationally recognized expert on immigration and human trafficking. She's the co-author of the first casebook on human trafficking and currently co-directs the Anti-Trafficking Litigation Assistance and Support Team and was a gubernatorial appointee to the California Alliance to Combat Trafficking and Slavery. And in 2013, she was appointed to the Los Angeles Police Commission. So specifically, the department within the Department of Labor that Alex Acosta is the Secretary of Labor and oversees, for the 2020 fiscal year budget, the department that you're talking about is called the International Labor Affairs Bureau. And This bureau has a budget of $68 million last year. And if you get the 80% cuts that Acosta is proposing, their budget in 2020 would be $18.5 million. So that is pretty much putting them out of business, isn't it? 80%?
That's a severe reduction, and I would agree with that conclusion that that kind of reduction in funding and resources does not equip, basically deprives this division of any ability to do the kind of work that it was doing, to provide technical assistance to non-governmental and governmental agencies around the world that are integral, critical in preventing human trafficking globally.
Well, President Trump, of course, yesterday was asked about his stance in terms of Acosta because of the focus now from the arrest of Jeffrey Epstein, who Acosta, when he was a U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Florida, gave him a sweetheart deal that's just quite extraordinary. It went so far as to immunize co-conspirators. It was done in great secrecy. And now that Epstein, who was able to escape justice then, is now having been arrested. Any impression you got from the press conference with the U.S. attorneys in New York is they're pretty determined to right the wrong. Would you agree with me on that?
Yes. Yeah, I absolutely agree on that. I didn't have an opportunity to see the whole press conference, but I found Acosta's answers. First of all, I found his statement underwhelming and strained credibility. The justifications that he gave for the under-enforcement of Epstein's sex trafficking crimes in the past did not hold water. It's absolutely not true that only more recently has there been a culture shift within our legal regime to combat human trafficking. Again, the federal law was passed in 2000. In particular, there's always been an emphasis and focus on minors that are engaged in commercial sexual activity. They're de facto victims even before the Trafficking Victims Act was passed. That's because they're under 18, and by virtue of their age, they cannot legally consent to any kind of commercial sexual activity. So therefore, any user of that sexual activity is a perpetrator. And in 2008, as well as now, there has been a lot of domestic government effort to enforce child sex trafficking crimes. In the question and answer period, his defense of his defense of choosing non-prosecution because the victims would be owed mandatory restitution, and then the defense would have used that fact against them, also is complete hogwash and does not hold water. Mandatory restitution is the right of every victim of crime, and it is spelled out again in our trafficking laws that it is a right since 2000 for trafficking victims to receive mandatory restitution. It simply doesn't matter whether or not the prosecution, the fact that mandatory restitution is a legal requirement does not affect the outcome of a trafficking prosecution.
Well, so you're talking about, of course, the press conference that took place today with Acosta defending himself. And
right.
And I mentioned the press conference that took place a couple of days ago in New York with U.S. Attorney Berman. And my impression from that press conference was that they're determined to right this wrong. Now, you've made a very good case that Acosta did not do himself any favors today. And I don't know why the press didn't ask him the question about why did you meet secretly with Epstein's lawyers, Dershowitz, Alan Dershowitz and Ken Starr, which is highly unusual for a prosecutor to meet in secret with the attorneys for the defendant. So that was a very...
Absolutely.
But let's talk about Donald Trump. Yesterday he said... when he was asked about him, and he said this many, many times, that Acosta is an excellent Secretary of State. He's doing a great job. He even went so far yesterday to say that he feels sorry for Acosta. What do you think he means? What reasons do we have to feel sorry for this man?
There isn't any legitimate reason to feel sorry for Acosta or Epstein, and I believe Trump may have shared a compassionate opinion about Epstein's dilemma as well. I think that Trump's statements are consistent with his long history of problematic treatment of women and all minorities, including people of color and vulnerable populations living at the margins. And really, it's fascinating that he would support those complicit in human trafficking in this sex trafficking case, because human trafficking as a sociological phenomenon, the demographics of its victims are exactly the type, the population that Trump, since his presidency began, has targeted with draconian measures, children at the border, women, and, if we think about human trafficking more broadly and the labor trafficking issue, by media reports, Trump's employment or his resort's employment of undocumented workers and, in some instances, those workers complaining of exploitive conditions. So it comes as no surprise to me, Trump's endorsement of Acosta. But as an anti-trafficking scholar, I find it deeply troubling.
Well, let me trouble you some more. The Trump's Doral, his golf course, one of his golf courses. Mm-hmm. Next week, they have a big tournament, a golf tournament, where you can pick your caddies from a group of strippers from a local striptease operation. And you get to spend the weekend with the strippers. And the logo is a guy in the background about to strike a ball that's sitting on a golf tee, and the golf ball has a big kiss on it, lipstick kiss on it.
Wow.
Which, I think without, the visual sort of says, beating women.
Sleazy. I mean, it's just,
it's beyond belief.
Beyond comprehension. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is what he's advertising at his golf course at this very moment with all this stuff going on with Acosta. I'd like to put the graphic up on my website just so people know what we're talking about here. But just in the last minute or so, Kathleen Kim, let's talk a little bit. We talked about Acosta's proposal to cut the enforcement budget in the Labor Department that enforces sex trafficking both here in the United States and globally, the International Labor Affairs Bureau. He's going to cut its budget to $68 million last year. He's going to cut it by 80% down to $18.5 million. Conversely, the Democrats, who control the House and therefore control the purse strings, they've responded to Acosta's 2020 plans with a budget that they would see the ILAB resources expand to $122 million. So how's this going to play out? I mean, can you see Trump vetoing this?
So I'm going to make a reference to one of Acosta's responses during the press conference today. And he responded to a journalist who was asking about the inconsistency of that budget cut with the mandate of his department to engage in anti-human trafficking. He said that, in the legislative cycle, this is how things go. The administration proposes a budget, we'll get pushback, and in the end, the budget won't really be cut. as much, or, you know, even maybe not at all. So I agree. I disagree with Acosta's response to that question. I think that he was maneuvering and evading a concrete answer, as he was with the other questions. And I mean, I hope that the Democrats push very hard for an increase in the IOAB budget, because that budget, it not only addresses sex trafficking, it's human trafficking in general, so, which is a much wider phenomenon of coerced labor exploitation across the globe. And that budget goes towards assisting developing countries that send potential human trafficking victims to our country, where they will be victimized. And I'll say I say another thing, which is not directly responsive to your question, but just as a point of clarification. The Department of Labor, or and even Acosta, can make the argument that the Department of Labor's jurisdiction is solely over labor trafficking versus sex trafficking. But all the sociological evidence about human trafficking depicts a much more complex picture. And particularly when child human trafficking victims are involved, they are subjected to both coerced labor in so-called legal industries as well as the commercial sex industry. Or they may be subjected to forced labor while also being sexually exploited. So the Department of Labor, while Acosta may argue, again, only has jurisdiction over coerced or human trafficking in so-called legal industries, it's not the case that there's a clear line between labor and sex trafficking. So I hope the Democrats are aware of that. So I'm very happy that they're pushing hard, or that they are going to propose a larger budget. I do not have confidence that Trump will accept it, however.
Well, Kathleen Kemah, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kathleen Kemah, professor of law at Loyola Law School and a nationally recognized expert on immigration and human trafficking. She is co-author of the first casebook on human trafficking and currently co-directs the Anti-Trafficking Litigation Assistance and Support Team, and was a gubernatorial appointee to the California Alliance to Combat Trafficking and Slavery. And in 2013, she was appointed to the Los Angeles Police Commission. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the billionaire Tom Steyer as the latest candidate to enter the crowded Democratic presidential field. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Maurice Pearl, who serves as the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of 200 high-net-worth Americans who are committed to building a more prosperous, stable, and inclusive nation. And he has a recent article at patrioticmillionaires.org, Rich People's Charity Won't Save the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Maurice Pearl.
Great to be in your show, Ian. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Maurice. And what do you make of this crowded Democratic field, just as one candidate drops out, Swalwell, who really wasn't going anywhere, another candidate enters the race, Tom Steyer, the billionaire hedge fund guy from Northern California, who's been running a bunch of ads calling for Trump's impeachment. Does this fit into the category that you were discussing in your article about rich people's charity won't save the world?
Well, I mean, in a way, I mean, Mr. Steyer has a great deal of money, but I think what we want is a democracy where all of the people get to decide how our money is spent. Now, he's perfectly welcome to run in the primary, and he's perfectly welcome to spend as much as he wants of his money to support his campaign. I have no objection to that. But I wouldn't say that his being rich gives him some special insight or special privilege or something, or shouldn't anyway.
Well, that's what Donald Trump ran on, Morris. Remember, I'm a rich guy. I buy politicians. I know how the game is played, and I'll do a better job than anybody. We've heard that one before, haven't we?
Yeah, he did run on that. I mean, I don't think Mr. Steyer is going to run on his ability to buy politicians.
No, but there is an assumption, is there not? Maybe it's a cultural situation in this country that if you're rich and successful, therefore it sort of means that you're smarter, better positioned, better equipped. Is that the argument? I don't think that's the argument that Tom Steyer is making, but it certainly seems to be out there in terms of the way people are beginning to see things, and certainly those that voted for Trump.
Well, both of these guys are rich. That's true, and they are smart people. But I think that you have to make a decision who to vote for based on what kind of policies they're going to implement. Whether or not you think Trump is rich or a good person or a smart businessman or, you know, whether you like him personally or not, I think I'm very much opposed to many of the policies that he and the Republican Party are promoting, such as, you know, lower taxes for rich people, and such as all of the other, you know, things he's doing with the new immigrants and things like that. So I'm very much against those policies. I'm not against him because he's rich, but perhaps they go hand in hand.
Well, I guess the analogy that I would make is, in terms of Trump, I don't want to belabor Trump, it's bad enough having to cover him on a daily basis, let alone keep talking about him. But he did run as a populist, even though he's wealthy, although I think his wealth is largely exaggerated. And that would mean that Tom Steyer, do you think he has a problem with a populist message at the same time being a billionaire?
I mean, Tom Steyer has made a huge thing about promoting our need to address the environment and global warming. I have no problem with that. He's talked about the problem with our congresspeople, our senators, our representatives, our presidents, sort of being captured by the wealthy donors they've spent so much time with. Now, I don't know if he will really be better. I mean, no, he won't be captured by any other wealthy donors because he is a wealthy donor himself. But I don't know if that actually solves the problem in terms of changing policies that affect people's lives. I don't think people are voting, very many people are voting anyway, based on process things about, you know, how you finance your campaign or what you think about how the campaign should be run. I think people are voting based on issues of that will affect them. How will this candidate's policies affect my job or my health care or my environment that I live in with my family? And I think to have a successful campaign, you have to be able to talk to those people and address that. Mr. Trump was able to do that, and he somehow convinced a lot of voters that he would do things to save their jobs if they, you know, worked for Carrier, or he would do things that would affect their day-to-day lives. And I think now they've had, you know, almost 3 years to see what's happening, 2.5 years. And I think they'll make a different decision on the next election day.
And again, I'm speaking with Morris Pearl, who serves as the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of 200 high net worth Americans who are committed to building a more prosperous, stable, and inclusive nation. And he has a recent article at patrioticmillionaires.org, Rich People's Charity Won't Save the World. So let's talk about the work that you do lobbying on Capitol Hill, because there's been a number of wealthy individuals who've written op-eds. For example, Eli Broud had a piece, I think it was in the New York Times or Washington Post, saying, "I'm a billionaire, please tax me." That's been largely one of your main messages, hasn't it, is that the beneficiaries of Trump's tax cuts and earlier tax cuts by George W. Bush, et cetera. In other words, you're advocating for leveling the playing field and dealing with rising inequality.
Yes, sir. We very much believe, and have been advocating for 10 years, that having lower taxes for the rich people and more for the everyday working Americans, is not actually even good for wealthy business people and investors. Yes, in the short term, I've been making more money. My stocks have been going up because the companies that I invest in have paid less taxes. But I'm very much afraid in the long run, we're going to have a lot of people who are not able to participate, not able to pay their bills every month, not able to be buying iPhones and signing up for cable TV and doing all the other things to help me make money and help our other members make money. And, you know, pretty soon we're going to have like what Nick Hanauer, you know, warned us about, of people marching around with pitchforks. And I don't want that. So I think it's in my own and our members' enlightened long-term self-interest not to have this gross inequality that we're seeing here in America.
Well, I remember interviewing Nick Hanauer a number of years back, and he made the case that a rich guy like him can't buy, you know, 100 cars. He can only buy two or three cars. He can only go out to one or two restaurants a week, maybe, but not out to several hundred. It sort of reminds me of Bill Gates' father's remark that you can't sail two yachts at the same time. So I take it that that's what the economy needs. At least that's what you and your colleagues believe, that needs more wealth distributed in order to stimulate the economy and spread the wealth and generate income.
Yes. I mean, my wealth is going up a lot over the past years, and I've not really changed my lifestyle at all. Yes, I have more money in my bank, and that's fine for me, but it doesn't really affect anyone else very much. Whereas for most people, if they suddenly get more money, they're going to spend some of that money, and that'll help all the businesses where they spend their money. And, you know, that's well known, that regular people have a much higher propensity to consume as opposed to rich people who have a higher propensity to save when they get additional money. It's consuming that drives our economy, not saving.
So in terms of we started out talking about this crowded Democratic field where one guy drops out, Congressman Swalwell, and another enters, Tom Steyer. And it is fairly, there's a lot of people that sort of represent the left side of the Democratic Party, with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren being somewhat conspicuous in that regard. You've got Joe Biden sort of representing the center. One of the more promising centrist candidates didn't even make it to the debate, the governor of Montana, Governor Bullock. So what's your sense then of where this is heading in terms of, I mean, I'm not going to ask you about who you're going to vote for, but assuming, just for the sake of an argument, that you feel that the country is not necessarily in the right direction and would want a change, how do you see that coming about?
Well, frankly, I think that all of them would be a huge improvement over the current incumbent. I think that a lot of people are trying to figure out who they think will be best in performing the general election. That seems to be the criteria that a lot of people are using, and even doing polls of Iowa potential caucus goers. That's what they say they want, is to think of who is the most likely to win in the general election. And I think, you know, people like Mr. Bullock, Governor Bullock, think that that could be their lane to success. He's won, you know, statewide office in Montana three times now. You know, and so that's sort of the case for the ones they call, you know, the centrists, for lack of a better term. There's also the case for people like Senator Warren, who are really able to rile up all of the Democratic base, possibly much more so than any of the center lane candidates. And so that's the debate. You know, and I don't know what's going to happen. I don't really know any more than anyone else does.
Sure. But we were talking earlier about the need for a better distribution of income so that that would benefit the economy by having more people with purchasing power. I mean, even a reactionary anti-Semite like Henry Ford understood that you had to pay your workers enough to buy your product. And I wonder whether that has been sort of lost on a lot of powerful capitalists in this country.
Well, I think it's been lost on some. I don't actually think it's been lost on that many. I think that a lot of people are on our side. As you've said, there's been a lot of these op-eds written that saying the rich should be taxed more and less of a burden should be on the, you know, regular working Americans. So I think there's actually a lot more people who believe that than the people who are just sort of thinking about their short term, you know, will I have more or less money over the next year? I think a lot of people really are smarter than they get credit for and really are thinking about multiple years. You know, most people are trying to figure out what they think is best for the country. And I give them credit for that. And it's, do we have to make sure they understand that what's best for the country is not some austerity that drives the economy down, but some more inclusive system where everyone has the ability to participate that drives the economy upward and forward and expanding?
Well, it would seem to me then that some of the proposals by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren in terms of forgiving student debt, or at least some finding a way to remove that burden, I find it particularly onerous that young people with college degrees should be so indebted before they even get a job that their lives are kind of shackled. And it is extraordinary, particularly people who go to law school and medical school, they accrue a lifetime of debt. And it would seem to me more logical that we should be investing in our kids, our students, as opposed to, we should see them as centers of investment as opposed to centers of profit. So how would you address the student loan, or what would your advice be to candidates on the student loan issue? Because it seems to me that if you make the argument, as you have made, that there needs to be more purchasing power and it needs to be spread down from the top, these kids today are so saddled with debts before they even get a job, they're not going to be able to buy homes, cars, refrigerators, etc.
I agree with you. I think the solution, we go back to the system we had when I went to college, that a much higher percentage of the cost of education was being paid directly to the universities and colleges by the government. The amount of money being spent by the taxpayers by the university had gone down, forcing the universities to greatly increase the amount of money they get the students to pay. And I think that's indirectly what's caused the problem, is the huge increase in the amount of tuition that our students are being expected to pay, far more than they can realistically expect to be able to pay back. And I think that's causing the problem. And I think we have to address the actual cost of education by going back to the system that we had when America was great, according to the guys in the red hats, where, and that was when the government paid so much of the cost of these, of education in general.
Well, the period that you're talking about, if you go back to the days of the American dream, that was Dwight David Eisenhower, Republican president. And during those days, the wealthiest individuals had 92% tax, did they not?
And America was very successful in the days of President Eisenhower and the Republicans. I think we need a lot of things were very different in those days, and we need to go back to some of those policies that that were very successful then.
Well, Morris Pearl, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you very much. Great to be in your show.
And again, I've been speaking with Morris Pearl, who serves as the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of 200 high net worth Americans who are committed to building a more prosperous, stable, and inclusive nation. And he has a recent article at patrioticmillionaires.org, Rich People's Charity Won't Save the World. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.